Let's have some questions today. I'm going to start with a kind of basic question that, just to respond to it, it's just for clarity. The question, why is this practice in particular offered to experienced students versus beginning? So I just want to clarify here, this retreat is offered for experienced students. I offer this practice for beginners also. There's another retreat in particular that we offer here at IRC in April. That's open to everyone. So just wanted to clarify that this is not, I do not consider this a practice for experienced students. This is a retreat for experienced students. Would you talk about how ignorance and delusion relate? And the confusion about or wondering about, is there ignorance in delusion? And there were, in this note, it offered some reflections of their own on ignorance and delusion, but I'll just speak to some of my understanding here. So there are two words used in the Pali for ignorance and delusion. Ignorance, avijja. The main place I know that word being used in the Buddha's teaching is at the head of the list of dependent origination, which basically is a description of how suffering comes to be. So ignorance being the kind of foundation of the arising of suffering. And then the word delusion is primarily used in the triad of root unwholesome states that are the basis of all unwholesome states that lead to suffering. Greed, aversion, and delusion. And the words there are lobha, greed, dosa, aversion, and moha for delusion. And so there are two different words in the Pali for these two things. And there's not a lot of description of a difference between them. There's a definition of ignorance in the suttas that talk about dependent origination, and the main definition for ignorance is not understanding the Four Noble Truths. There are probably some other definitions scattered through the suttas. The main place or way that delusion seems to be connected, although I don't think it's particularly, it may not be particularly defined in this way as a definition. I don't know, Diana, maybe you can tell me this. But the delusion, basically the delusions around taking what is impermanent to be permanent, taking what is unreliable to be reliable, taking what is not self to be self, that this is the way, one of the ways delusion is described. And so one way to explore these words is looking at the Pali. Avijja, translated as ignorance, is the word basically is absence of wisdom, avijja. So a means negation, that prefix, and then vijja means something like wisdom or understanding. And so ignorance can be considered the absence of something, the absence of understanding the truth of the Four Noble Truths. Moha, delusion, is talked about as something arising as a presence in the mind, as an obscuration, as a clouding. And so that is the misperception of taking what is impermanent to be permanent is an activity of mind. It's an arising in the mind. And so delusion, understood as something that is arising, we see the arising of delusion. And this is an actually an interesting thing to begin to recognize in our practice. I'll take a moment to just talk about that. This has actually come up in one or two of the groups, that delusion is hard to see because it obscures. And often we don't know it's there because it's got this obscuring nature. We are taking ourselves to be a self, and it just feels right. You know, it's like that feels right. That's, yeah, I'm here. Where else would I be? And yet there are times when through this practice, through the careful seeing of experience, we begin to see into the insubstantiality of the aggregates. We see the body as just sensation coming and going. Our experience of the body is just sensation coming and going. We experience feeling as something that is arising and passing. We recognize our experience as conditioned, as tumbling on, and nothing stable or solid anywhere in that flow of experience. And we experience or recognize that sense of me being here, who I am, and it may be, it can be these delusions are seen through in smaller ways too, like just around a particular habit or pattern of identification for myself, a pattern or habit of identification of self-hatred. That was a very strong pattern in my mind. And then at some points, kind of recognizing or seeing it just collapse and fall away, just the recognition of this is simply a misunderstanding. A thought arises and there's a belief arising around this, and just the seeing of that exposed the delusion associated with that self-hatred. As we see more deeply into the aggregates, we begin to expose the delusions, the deeper delusions around impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, taking them to be permanent, reliable, controllable, taking experience to be that. And as we see into this, as we see through these delusions for a few moments, perhaps, it's like that fog of delusion through which we had been seeing, believing, interpreting reality from that perspective, that fog just falls away, and we are seeing things in a completely different way. It's like the fog going away here. It's really easy to see the trees now. It's trivial, you know. You don't have to get up close to them, or you know, it's just like you just see them. And it's like that as delusion falls away. It seems so obvious that the whole notion, in my case around self-hatred, that the whole notion of self-hatred is just ludicrous. It's a mistake. It's just a thought arising in the mind that's being believed, has no basis in any reality whatsoever. And it seems very obvious in that moment. How can I not see this? And so this is the falling away of that delusion, of that obscuration that was present in the mind. And yet, our minds are deeply, deeply conditioned, those habits of greed, aversion, and delusion, those habits there are deeply conditioned. And so, for instance, that habit of self-hatred of mine, I mean, actually, that time that I was thinking in my mind in that moment of a time when the mind really, the first time it really so clearly saw through the delusion of self-hatred, it was such a clear belief, you know, a clear sense of seeing that, not a belief. It was a clear sense of seeing that. There was such a release around it. For a moment, there was the arising of the belief or the arising of the thought, figured it out. I will never experience self-hatred again. Quickly, actually, in that experience, though, the mind recognized, well, yeah, I'm seeing through it right now. And in fact, while that particular understanding was very powerful in terms of releasing the mind from its conditioned pattern of self-hatred, there were times that it arose again. And so in those times when it comes back, after we have seen through a delusion, when it comes back, to understand that it's not some like fatal flaw on our part. It's just the conditioning of those habits and patterns is so strong that the power of seeing through it in a moment, it's there. The power of the seeing is there in that moment, allows us to penetrate through that delusion in that moment. But then the conditions change, and the conditions that support the re-arising of that delusion come. And so we get caught again by that. But the big difference in that situation there is that having seen through the delusion once, or twice, or three times, however many times, having seen through the delusion, we can now recognize this is delusion at work. This feeling of self-hatred, I know very deeply, this is just a construct of the mind. It has no basis in reality. And so knowing that it's delusion, it may not mean that experience then transmutes into the delusion falling away. But it's powerful to recognize delusion as delusion. Because when we recognize delusion as delusion, when we don't recognize delusion as delusion, basically delusion is a form of belief in a way. It's a kind of a belief that has us taking that belief to be truth. And so embedded in that self-hatred was a belief that this was true. I am an unworthy person who's a failure, that was true. And having seen through that, recognizing the thought, you're no good, you're a failure, that was just a thought. That was essentially what was seen there. Having seen through that, there was an undermining of that belief and a recognition of that belief is just a thought. And so when it arose later, the mind could recognize this is a belief. It's not truth. There's a deep understanding and a knowing of the conditioned nature of that belief and the recognition that yes, the mind happens to be caught by that right now. And so the recognition of the beliefs around delusion as beliefs is vastly different than simply believing them to be true. It gives us a little space, a little gap of navigation in which we have some choice about our relationship to that belief. And so this is a, it sounds like potentially a small difference to be able to recognize delusion as arising versus just being deluded, but it's a big difference. And so having seen through delusion, we can now start to see delusion at work. See that activity of that obscuring activity of mind at work. And so in terms of ignorance and delusion, when wisdom is not present, my understanding is this, when wisdom is not present, there is delusion. Bhikkhu Bodhi actually says that they're really simply two words for the same phenomenon, and that it's not really, in his sense, they aren't really different things. Although it is potentially the Buddha used different words for them, and so potentially it does point to these two sides. One, the absence of something, the absence of wisdom in terms of ignorance, and the presence of something, the obscuring misperceptions in terms of delusion. But my understanding is that when ignorance is present, delusion is present. When delusion is present, ignorance is present. There's not even a kind of a one encapsulating the other. They're almost synonymous in terms of what's happening in the present moment. We could describe the experience of delusion as ignorance. Since I don't think I'll have an opportunity to do a whole talk on delusion on this retreat, I'm going to say one more piece about delusion, just because it's such a helpful topic to have a little bit of framing and context around. One of the key delusions, which I mentioned earlier, key delusions which are uprooted as we see the coreless, insubstantial nature of the aggregates. Taking what's impermanent to be permanent, unreliable to be reliable, not self to be self. Those are the core, what we could call human delusions. We all share these delusions. And they are the deepest ones, the often the hardest to see, partly because we share them as human beings. We share them. And so everybody shares these perspectives. And then they're also just very deeply conditioned. There are some other kinds of delusions, some like higher level delusions. One of the kind of basic forms of delusion is just basically being not mindful, being disconnected from experience, not aware, the mind being just not in touch. That's a form of delusion. That's probably the most basic form of delusion. And then there's delusions that our own personal delusions. We call them personal delusions, cultural delusions, societal delusions, ones that are conditioned into us personally, maybe into our culture, into our families. These are beliefs that we share with groups of people potentially, or maybe we have conditioned things, like for myself, the conditioning around self-hatred, that was a very personal, framing of my value as a human being based on my conditioning and my experience. And so that was a kind of more personal delusion. And then there's delusions that are more connected with our culture, our society, how we're trained as a culture, what we value as a culture, what we take to be right and wrong. A lot of this is cultural, and we see a lot of this today in the political divisions. People really having views about what's right, and this is right and that is wrong. So these are views that are being held to as truth rather than being understood as different perspectives on reality brought into being based on conditions and how we were raised and what we had experienced in our lives. And so again, it's beginning to recognize. So in this case, it's really looking at the connection between views and delusion. We will always have views. We will have views. And in many ways, the use of views in our practice supports us to shift from being caught by views to being able to see views as views. This is an important difference. One way to understand the view of right view is it's a view that helps us understand that views are conditioned. It's a view that helps us to understand that views are when clung to, create suffering. That they are conditioned, they arise based on volition. So that understanding essentially helps us to recognize even the views of the Dharma as conditioned, which is an interesting recognition. So we use the views of the Dharma to help the mind begin to recognize where suffering is being created. The whole direction of the practice from the perspective of what the Buddha taught is what frees the mind from suffering. And so the views that are held, or the views that are used in right view, are views that support the mind to recognize and understand how suffering operates. And the Buddha famously pointed to how the Dharma, even Dharma, the Eightfold Path in this teaching, even the Eightfold Path, if clung to, will create suffering. He said, wholesome states are not to be clung to. How much more so unwholesome states are not to be clung to? The other piece I'll just say about delusion is that greed and aversion, the other two root unskillful states that underlie all of the unskillful states, greed, aversion, delusion, that triad we say so many times. Suffering is based on greed, aversion, and delusion. Freedom is understood to be the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. This is one of the key definitions the Buddha offered for the mind that is free and at peace. The mind that is free, released from greed, aversion, delusion. So this is one of the key understandings of our practice, is seeing greed, aversion, delusion at work and beginning to understand how they lead to suffering. The mind begins to let go of that direction. And so greed and aversion have delusion inside of them. Greed and aversion are shot through with delusion. The greed itself is kind of a leaning towards the kind of sticky quality of, oh yeah, nice, let me stay in touch with that. So it's kind of got that sticky quality, greed. And aversion kind of has this tendency to separate, you know, it's like, that's its job, separation. And so that's, you know, when there's something unpleasant, the mind wants to separate from it, whether it's to annihilate it, to push it away, to take ourselves away. There's this quality of wanting to separate with aversion. And so those are the feelings or the qualities themselves of greed and aversion. But greed and aversion are based on delusion. And for greed, the delusion embedded in greed is having that thing is what's going to make me happy. And that's a belief. The whole project of greed is based on a belief that the having of something will make me happy. And likewise with aversion, the whole the delusion embedded in aversion is the belief that being separated from that thing is what's going to make me happy. Again, the project of doing the separation and separating is founded on the belief that it will lead to happiness. That happiness that results from being connected with what one likes and being separated from what one doesn't like, the happiness that comes with that, there is a form of happiness that comes with that. And the Buddha acknowledged that. Yes, there's a happiness that comes with that. It's not a reliable happiness, however, because what we are clinging to, what we are pushing away, that whole project of craving is orienting around things that are impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. And so the happiness that comes from the getting what we want, getting what we don't want, is quite fleeting. And so this is actually what the Buddha points us to in terms of investigating the happiness that comes with, you know, he doesn't tell us not to my sense of his teaching in this one particular case, he says we should understand the gratification and the danger and the escape in respect to sense pleasure. And so what's gratifying about having sense pleasure? Sense pleasure here, including the pleasure of being separated from what we don't like. So what's gratifying about that? It feels good to have what we want. It feels good to get rid of what we don't want. How long does that last? He asks us to look at that. How satisfying actually is it? And we start to see that it's not terribly lasting. And also, we see that as soon as we've got something we want, basically, our mind is kind of like, okay, got that thing. But at some level, we kind of know, okay, it's going to only last for so long. So better start lining my ducks up in a row to get the next thing so that I can have that thing before this thing goes away. And we are just on this endless project of getting what I want, getting rid of what I don't want, tied to this fleeting happiness. And so the happiness of the release from greed, aversion, delusion, the absence, the non-arising of greed, aversion, delusion, the happiness that comes with that, we actually can start to get a taste of it in our practice when we see, in moments, we might see a wanting go away. We might see, you know, just practice with it sometimes, a time when you might be wanting something, an extra sweet at the meal or some particular extra cup of tea or something. Just notice the wanting and explore what happens if you don't act on the wanting, but just watch the wanting. Watch the wanting. At times, not always, but sometimes we actually can watch the wanting and watch it fade. Even at times, watch it just release. Watch that wanting for something to release. When we see that wanting release, we get a taste of what the happiness of the non-arising of wanting would be like, what the happiness of release from wanting is like. And so that delusion embedded in greed and aversion of having this thing will make me happy. Basically, that delusion, getting rid of this thing will make me happy, having this thing will make me happy, that delusion cannot possibly understand a happiness apart from the having or the getting rid of. And so when we're caught by that delusion, we can't, or the mind can't recognize the possibility of a different kind of happiness. But again, having seen at times that release from the delusion of having to get this thing, you know, the release from the wanting is a release from that delusion. As we see that release, and sometimes we can actually feel it let go. At times I've seen that it's felt like being released from a vice grip. The mind just having to have something, need something, and then realizing, oh, actually, no. Different kind of happiness. It's a pointer. It's a pointer to the happiness of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. That's probably enough about delusion and ignorance. And maybe as a follow-on from that, actually, can you briefly review how impermanence and unreliability don't lead to not caring about the various semi-permanent objects that populate our lives? I always get confused about this. Things last long enough to care about. So, ... So this is, connecting to the seeing the truths of impermanent, unreliable, not self. That's the falling away of that delusion. How might that not lead to not caring? So kind of a sense of, if things are impermanent and unreliable, why would I care about them? A little bit of a confusion in there, perhaps. And so the question of how might it not lead to not caring about the various semi-permanent objects that populate our lives? Things do seem to linger for a while, although experientially, in every single moment, experientially, which is the exploration around the aggregates, is really a exploration deeply of the experiential level of what's happening in our lives. And at the experiential level, moment to moment, nothing lingers at all. There's nothing even inherently existing at all. This is what we were exploring yesterday, the insubstantiality of the five aggregates. Insubstantiality, my understanding there, meaning nothing inherently existing. In this moment, what's coming together is already falling apart. This is the actuality of the experiential level of experience. And And so how does this truth, how might this truth like jibe with caring? This is a confusion, I think, at times that we might have, and I've experienced in my own practice at times, you know, and see here with other people, it's like fear arising, for instance, around something being unreliable or lack of safety, you know, the feeling of lack of safety around things being uncontrollable. And sometimes people kind of using these understandings of like, well, I shouldn't be afraid. I know that things are really unreliable, uncontrollable. So, you know, this fear or this wanting it to be controllable is just wrong, or this wanting to be safe, the wanting to be safe, the wanting to be happy, the wanting to be healthy there. That's just, it's not a valid want, because things are unreliable. That might be what our minds do with this kind of understanding around impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, that the wishes of may I be safe and happy, may I be healthy, that those wishes are not valid. And so it seems like on the surface of it, when we just reflect on, when we think about impermanent, unreliable, that might be what our minds do with it. That these wishes are not valid, or that we shouldn't care somehow, or that if I'm caring about something that's impermanent, I'm setting myself up for some kind of suffering. And so that's not what I'm supposed to do. So I'm not supposed to care. The wishes for safety, happiness, well-being are deeply embedded in us as human beings, and these are wholesome wishes. This is metta. This is love, connection. May I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy. And yet there is this confusion around what we could call these core, like, wishes that come with being human, and these core truths. A lot of our suffering is born when the threads of these two, the core wishes and the core truths, get tangled up. It's like they get knotted up, as I was describing, that the confusion around, well, if things are impermanent, unreliable, then I shouldn't care. I shouldn't want to care. But I do care. So the other thing that seems to happen is that we get angry at the world. It's like the world is like betraying me. Either I'm failing somehow or the world is betraying me. And so if we land it, you know, so we kind of have this tangle here is the the mind of the kind of connecting to the core wishes of love and compassion and connection, feeling like if this is how the heart, if this is a valid expression of the heart, then these truths of impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable are just wrong. And yet we see this is the truth. And so there's this knotting up that happens. And so pretty much I've started to kind of recognize that whenever there's suffering present, any kind of suffering, anger, confusion, irritation, you know, whatever it is, subtle or obvious, it's usually a tangle of these pieces, these threads. There's the mind is creating a conflict between these two sides, between the love and the truth. It's creating conflict there and feeling like these two don't work together. How can I be safe when things are unreliable? I shouldn't want to be safe then, since things are unreliable. And so we have this mental machinations going on. And so our suffering is born from this conflict of the mind thinking that one or the other has to go. One or the other is just wrong somehow. And yet the suffering is like a tangle, you know, it is a tangle. These threads are all tangled up and we feel like, you know, somehow we might think that we need to have that suffering go away. We might feel like we have to get rid of that suffering by, you know, in this example around the knotting up of these threads, by taking scissors and cutting the knot out, because the knot is the problem. You know, that's where the suffering is in the knot, and so we need to cut the knot out. But as soon as we try to do that, we end up with a hole in our fabric. And so, you know, this is not the way. I used to believe this around my self-hatred, that if I could just find the edges and it's like a tumor, I could just get the thing and cut it out. But pieces of that self-hatred were connected to wanting to be connected, wanting to be seen, having connection with others and feeling relationship. And so in meeting our suffering, in meeting our suffering, recognition here we can explore is that the knot is composed of the threads of love and truth. And that actually the cutting out of that is not going to be a possibility, because our system is not going to let us really. It takes a repression of love. It takes a repression of that understanding of truth in order to try to do that cutting out. And what we're asked instead is to open to both. Our mindfulness practice is kind of, to me, like a bath that is this solvent that allows the threads to untangle, to help us come to the recognition that impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable are truths. And caring, connection, love, compassion are wholesome movements of the heart. And that the heart can hold both. And in fact, as the delusion around the confusion around, I think a lot of our, those wishes, for instance, you know, the wish to be happy, to be healthy, to be safe, the wish itself is wholesome. The demand that it be accomplished is the craving. And that's a hard one for us to realize and to release. But the wish itself, let your heart feel that wish and recognize the constriction, so that, you know, the part of our practice here is to feel the constriction when the love is not unfolding, or the idea of the but the idea of how it should unfold, when it's not unfolding in that way, we suffer in that way. But the wish for the connection is a wholesome wish. And so, you know, paradoxically, the more we open to these truths, and the idea that recognizing impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable would mean that we don't care is a misunderstanding, because the more we actually deeply open to that, to those truths, and allow our hearts to be open to connection without needing it to happen in a certain way, the more we open to both of these together, it's like the love gets deeper and the understanding of the truth gets deeper. These two actually support each other. The more the heart opens in love and isn't constricted about, I love you, you have to love me, you know, that more that unconditional quality of loving, the more we can take in these truths of impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, the more we take in those truths, the more our heart, like, oh, it's so poignant to recognize, as we see in our own hearts, how our hearts struggle and suffer against these truths and these wishes. When we see this in our own heart in a clear way, we recognize the humanity of the struggle. You know, it is a human struggle we are working with here. And we see this confusion multiplied. Or that when we see through the confusion, we feel the poignancy of having been caught by that confusion and recognize that's what's going on in 7.5 billion people in the world. And the heart actually breaks open holding that. And rather than not caring, we care more deeply. And so seeing that these truths, to me, it's only the confusion of belief that these two are incompatible. These beliefs, the core wishes for love and the truths of impermanent and unreliable. It's only the belief that they're incompatible that makes us think we wouldn't care. When we see through that belief, seeing deeply into the truth opens us to caring. and love and compassion more and more fully. The Buddha described these qualities of heart as boundless, and actually described on the path, on the journey of the path of wisdom, the cultivation of wisdom, that these qualities naturally grow. And we can see this happen. And so when you see this happening, trust this connection between wisdom and love. All of the exploration we're making around the insubstantiality, the emptiness of the five aggregates, maybe it sounds just, you know, purely wisdom. But those understandings can touch the heart, will touch the heart, and create the conditions for the Brahmaviharas, love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity to flower. So love and wisdom deeply connected. Let's sit for a few minutes.